funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to be funny? Watching talented comedians on stage is a little like watching Olympic figure skaters. When they're really killing, their talent convinces us that being up there is easy. We forget the kind of risks they take to make it all work and can almost imagine they're just making it all up as they go along. My guests today have been perfecting that illusion for years and will take the stage for two shows at Dallas's Backdoor Comedy Club on New Year's Eve. Paul Varghese has appeared on Comedy Central, Showtime, and NBC's Last Comic Standing. Aaron Aryanpour was voted one of Maxim Magazine Bud Light's Real Men of Comedy. By the way, I rarely get to mention Maxim Magazine on the show. And is a contributing comic to Life and Style Weekly magazine. Guys, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How is a New Year's Eve crowd different from an audience on any other night of the year?
For me, what I think is most of those people have never come out to a show the whole year. That is their big event. That and Valentine's Day is their big event to come out. So it's a lot of couples who spend money for the babysitter. So they're super happy, super energetic. That's the 8 o'clock show because they want to have fun and drive home before the drunks hit the streets.
Right.
Then the 10:30 show comes in drunk. And about the time that I go on stage, about 11:30 is when it starts to get chaotic because they're all ready to use their noisemakers. But it's still fun. I know how to handle it, so it's fun. But it gets as the time ticks down, you see people getting antsy.
Yeah, is there like a sweet spot of intoxication that you like for an audience to have? Because I would imagine there's a point after which it becomes kind of dangerous. Not physically dangerous, but...
Oh, no, it can be physically dangerous. No, it's... I don't know. You just want somebody to be relaxed. You know, you want a group to... And whatever that takes, you know... Alcohol doesn't always have to, you know, play a part. We've done enough like corporate shows where I'm fairly positive they weren't drinking. But there was always that limit where, you know, someone's bound to get rowdy.
The illusion that people need to be drunk to laugh is really stupid. The only reason comedy clubs say that is because they make their money off alcohol sales. If they made their money off balloon sales, everybody would be sitting there with a balloon. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't really dull the senses because like, we do so many corporate shows together, and they laugh just as loud. We were there we did a show on Friday, and they laughed just as loud as a regular crowd, and they weren't drunk. So it's kind of an illusion. But there is that. There's certain comedy clubs I know in L.A. that do not hand out shots at their comedy club because they don't want people getting completely blitzed. They want people just to relax. But again, on New Year's Eve, this is their one chance for a lot of people who never get to come out ever. So they kind of get trashed to the wind.
They're emotionally invested in their evening. They need to have a good time.
Yeah, this is their prom. You know, so you're not messing this up for me, Frank.
The limo's waiting out front.
Yeah, exactly.
Dad's expecting you home by 12:30. Do you then tailor your shows to the 8 o'clock crowd with the babysitter at home and the two kids? And then do you know something's going to be really different for the next show?
I'd say that plays a part in some other clubs, not necessarily at the back door, just because there's not going to be a more adult set or a raunchier set necessarily.
Because there's no raunch there, really.
Right. It's a really great, clever room. It fosters a lot of clean comedy. It's still, you know, on that edge, but it's nothing dirty. So you're never going to have like a late show where it's just all out. Certainly with the earlier crowds, they may be slightly older, so maybe I'll talk more about my family. Maybe I'll talk more about the corporate life or something like that. And I don't necessarily need to rely on that so much for the later show.
It's what I love about the back door is it's clean comedy, but it doesn't come across as clean comedy. If that makes any sense. And
yeah, it doesn't feel like you're watching it on the Christian Broadcasting Network or something.
Exactly. You're not watching fluff. You're watching people who are actually, and this is the greatest thing I love about this scene, is everybody is completely original. Nobody sounds alike. You're not going to hear any Tiger Woods jokes. I was at an open mic last night, and one of the bartenders, he was joking, but he was like, that's funny that you guys don't have any Tiger Woods jokes. He was happy because we don't care about topical stuff like that. It's all about trying to expand who we are creatively, personally. So when you go to that show, there's 8 or 10 people that go up and not one person sounds alike. Nobody's treading on the same thing. Nobody's doing, Tiger Woods jokes or topical stuff. They're just talking about what they know and what they feel is funny, which is how this city has morphed into, is nobody sounds alike in the city. It's probably the only city that I've been to traveling where none of the comics sound alike. Because like in Austin, you'll see a lot of guys doing one-liners or trying to be like super alt and super weird, because they feel they have to do that because that's what Austin is. And a lot of it's derivative from who the big comic is in that city. So like in Houston, Bill Hicks was the big influence in that city. So everybody tries to be him, tries to be edgy, tries to say things that they think are going to poke at people. But, you know, shock humor is dead. I mean, it's not dead, but everything that's been shocking has been said. So it's almost like a reaction now, as opposed to, like, Bill Hicks was, he's a big influence of mine, but he was actually saying stuff with what he said, and a lot of people lose sight of that. But in Dallas, there's not one big comic that made it huge and still comes back and comes to the shows. I mean, there's a lot of big comics here, you know, Robert Hawkins, who's really big, but everybody here, just there's no big voice that this city gravitates around. So everybody is so specific on being their own person, which is what I love about it.
Do you care if people who walk into the room think of you as an artist as opposed to an entertainer?
I love that. That's what I want. I don't want to be an entertainer. I would be a clown if I wanted to be an entertainer. Well, I wouldn't be a clown, but...
That's what I mean. Are you bothered if they just think, make me laugh, you're a clown?
I mean, I think that's what they come into. I don't think people ever think of it as an art. I think they just know they had a good time. I think the people who are real comedy nerds in the audiences really appreciate what me and Aaron and everybody else, you know, in Dallas are doing.
I don't think they even think of it in terms of art. You know, I mean, if you're doing it right, then they've just kind of had a one-way conversation with you, you know, and then you come off stage and everybody just wants to just talk like they know you. And
but that's what art is.
Exactly. But I don't think they necessarily, like, unless they're, you know, really into it, you know, if they, you know, are the comedy nerds out there, then they're not really, I don't think they're aware of it.
Yeah, I do a lot of jokes where I'm not saying a word on stage, where I'm almost miming, and audiences don't realize, very few people come up and go, I appreciate the fact that you actually did a joke without talking. That's impressive. They just sit there and go, that was funny. Most people think that. The comics know. The comics know what's clever and what's not and what's been done and what kind of weird angles you're kind of doing. The audiences don't really know. It's kind of like a basketball player. Like, nobody sees Kobe Bryant practicing. They don't realize that when he does a one-handed fadeaway that he's been practicing that, and that's amazing to do. They just say, oh, he scored 2 points. That's great. And I think that's the same way.
And that's what Paul thinks of himself.
I'm Kobe Bryant. I'm the Kobe Bryant of Dallas comedy. The good Kobe.
Before all the scandal.
Yes.
Or yeah. After all the scandal. I don't know.
Yeah, before after the diamond ring. I'm that Kobe.
Do you, I know that you both talk about your family and people in your lives. What kind of license do you give yourself when you sort of make a character out of someone that you actually know every element of their personality and you pick one thing out and make that something that you talk about?
I think it's maybe unfair, you know, on a personal level, you know, because you're never going to give that other person the other side. But if there's something that really bothered me, you know, something that my boss said, something that my father said, something that my kid said, and I know that my kid is a wonderful guy, says all sorts, but if there's one thing, I'm going to latch on to that because that's what I'm most passionate about at that moment, you know? I've created a character of my father, which is probably not that fair to him, but, it, you know, in all fairness, it's kind of how I view him. I don't know if it's a psychological thing or whatever, but he's the father that I'm not going to be able to please. And that kind of colors everything that he as the character is going to say, you know.
My when I do any talks about my parents or even ex-girlfriends or whatever, you just lump everybody into one because I can't sit there and say, well, my uncle, my second uncle, he did this. And then my other, no, this guy from my parents' church, he said this. So you just lump everybody into one.
Like an amalgamation.
Yeah, basically. So my dad is very passive. I mean, he's 5'5", short guy, doesn't say anything. He does, and so all my uncles are the ones who really have said a lot of this stuff that I say about him on stage, or it's people from his church. And I just lump it into him because it's an investment at that point. He's just, you know, same thing with the ex-girlfriend. You don't want to say, well, my girlfriend from 2005, she said this, because nobody cares. So you just lump them into this super character. And that's what I do, at least. I don't know.
Are there things that get harder to do as realities in your life change? Or do you just, once you've created a character or a bit that sort of lives on its own and it's separate from the reality that pushed it out there?
There were, well, to Paul's point, I mean, there were things that I experienced at a job I had like 2 jobs ago that the rage is still there, you know?
That's good for an artist.
Exactly. So the thing is, it's, but you know, it's the same kind of thing. I can't talk about how, oh, it's so much better now. You know, I'm 2 years removed from, you know, this hell that I experienced, because some of it's still very raw. Some of it I haven't forgiven. So it's still very real to me. And I will kind of hold on to that. I don't know, for better or for worse, you know, as long as I get entertainment out of it.
You know? I mean, there's definitely material that you drop over time because it's not as funny, or you're just not emotionally invested into it. every joke I do up there, I still feel emotionally invested into that joke. Even if I've been doing it for 4 years, I still love doing it. It still means something to me. But there's definitely, it's like you're talking about, like there's, it, to me, the audience, you're in the middle of your entire life and you're just pulling stuff from your life. They have no concept of, okay, if I talk about being Christian, audiences don't believe that I'm Christian. Even though I say it up there, they just think I'm...
Because you're Indian.
Yeah. Yeah. Or they just think I'm just talking up there. They don't believe anything you say, you know? If I sit there and say that I'm single, people don't... Anything I say, people don't actually honestly believe it some of the times. Because they just think... Because they're so used to watching terrible stand-up comedy where you see a guy playing a character and being phony, you know, and kind of just doing misdirections. And where, you know, there's a lot of comics where you watch and you're like, you know, hey, I was driving to the store and... You know, and then it's a twist. They weren't really at the store. They were at their mom's house. And so I think people are so trained to watching that kind of terrible stand-up. Well, I mean, it's terrible to me. I don't like it. To where you lose trust in a comic. You don't believe anything he says is the truth. So I try not to do that.
I also like it as a chronicle. I just realized that, you know, I started doing stand-up before I became a father. And so when we started going through the whole pregnancy thing and then having a baby thing, I mean, that material just kind of evolved over time, and it's stuff that I'm not doing anymore. But what I like is going back and, you know, watching old tapes or listening to old tapes and realizing that I'd been documenting, like, my mindset that whole time. And I thought that was kind of cool. It's the way I'm going to be most honest, is just talking about what's really going on as it's happening.
So. I think you get that. You first try to figure out how to be funny, and then once you know you can be funny and how to get a real laugh, then you can really start talking about what you want to talk about, which... You know, it doesn't have to be like major political and social issues. It's just stuff that you really want, that you really think is funny. But you have to know how to be funny first to get to that point. So,
when you listen to old tapes or watch old performances of yourselves, do you see in the very beginning this glimmer of what you are now, or do you think, God, what was I thinking, and how did I come from there to here?
Here's the biggest change for me, and this seems very probably minute to everybody else, but. My very first set, it went really well, but when I was doing impressions of my father, it was very hokey, over the top, Simpsons-esque, what I thought people would laugh at. It was very super animated and just eyes bugged out and just being dumb. And I look back and I'm like, that's not even authentic. That's just me trying to get a reaction off sounding silly. And so I made this conscious effort. I realized at a certain point that people were laughing at the goofy way that I was talking as opposed to what I was saying with it.
Right.
So I changed it to be way more subtle, to where people don't even laugh at that anymore. Like I have to say something funny with it, but it's incredibly subtle now. And I did that on purpose. That's the biggest change. Cause when I watched my earlier stuff, I'm like, what am I doing? I'm like basically doing a minstrel show with Indian stuff up there. I mean, it's really offensive. I mean, if I was an Indian kid watching that, I'm not proud of that guy, cause he's just making fun of us. And that's what I realized just by doing that accent. I felt that way. You know, I felt really embarrassed when I got off stage. I mean, I got laughs, but it didn't feel deserved. And then as soon as I changed it, probably a year or two in, I changed the subtleness of it. And now, you know, that's the biggest change for me, at least.
Less a caricature, more of a character. And
yeah.
Yeah. I got embarrassed just watching a tape I made a month ago. So, I mean...
That's why I never listened to the archives of my own show. I could really.
I was at that taping.
Yeah.
I was embarrassed for you.
Yeah. Oh, oof, it was awful.
we'll get more from you on that in just a minute. Aaron Aryanpour is here. Also, Paul Varghese. Both are performing at the Backdoor Comedy Club on New Year's Eve. You can find information about that online. Just go to backdoorcomedy.com. We'll take your calls as well in a moment. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Paul Varghese and Aaron Aryanpour, both of whom will appear at the Backdoor Comedy Club for two special shows on New Year's Eve. You can find information about that appearance at backdoorcomedy.com. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think at kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. How aware are you, not of the sort of general tide of laughter or lack of laughter, but of the one individual who is either just finds you incredibly funny or is sitting stony-faced in the middle of the room?
It goes both ways for me. I mean, I don't think the big cackle tends to be when everybody else quits laughing. It's one of those, but I rarely call it out. But the stone-faced, I have a big problem with that right now. The last couple of years, I've always been able to lock into the one person who's just arms crossed. And I have a bad problem sometimes of talking to them, like trying to figure out what's wrong and reason with them. He's seen how uncomfortable it gets.
It
rattles me.
It rattles the whole audience. It's some people come in with an expectation. I don't want to sit up front. The comedian's just going to pick on me. I don't want to be the focus. I don't want to be the butt of any jokes. And then they sit there stone-faced, angry, and then they bring attention to themselves. You know, they forget that, you know, it's not just the comedian seeing them. Everybody behind them can see them with their arms crossed and it seems like, you know, yeah, maybe they don't find what's going on stage funny, but, you know, it seems like they're almost determined, you know, to prove a point, you know, that I'm not going to find you funny whatsoever. And then they get upset when you, you know, try to reach them, you know, what's going on.
I think they're also used to watching, people feel uncomfortable in comedy clubs, like sitting in the front rows, because they're so used to watching comedy on TV where you see the guy pick on the guy in the front row. And, you know, I think there's maybe only a couple of comics at the back door that maybe even jump into that vat of snakes, but like I don't ever do it unless it's organic. Like if somebody yells something out, which happens fairly often, then I'll acknowledge it, but I never jump in because I was always taught to, they paid money to see a show, and so they paid money to see you do something, not talk to them, because you can talk to them at the bar afterwards. But a lot of times sometimes I have a big problem with crowd work where you're making fun of somebody in the audience, especially if they don't deserve it, because I think that's where the stone face comes from. They think you're going to make fun of them. Whenever I do crowd work, I always want to make sure that it's kind of a team thing where we're all laughing together. We're not laughing at you. I'm not going to make fun of you. On the flip side, sometimes, you know, I have those moments where I can't, I'm just in a bad mood. And
it's also usually in response to somebody who's, you know, really aggressive, you know, you have the drunk heckler, you know, you have somebody who thinks that they're helping the show, you know, like, I don't know what you were going to do. If I didn't pipe up, like we didn't have material prepared, and you know, just they think of themselves. I mean, the audience is a valuable part of that conversation. It's a conversation between them and you as the performer. But then they're the people that take it too far, that they think that they're the representative of the whole crowd.
There's also that thin line between who's heckling and who's just having a good time, because sometimes people are just laughing really loud and just repeating what they just heard. And it took me a while to figure that out, too, because I thought anybody who yelled out was against me. And that's like seventh grade insecure Paul didn't get to go to homecoming coming out, you know, like, you don't like me. And that's that Paul coming out. And so I would always just immediately go on the offensive. And then you start realizing those people are just having fun. You know, some people are just ordering drinks, you know, some people just, but then the people who really do not like you at a show will make sure to let you know. You won't have to decipher it, because I've seen comics who go up and like, what'd you say? No. If he really hated you, trust me, he's going to say it, because I've had it happen. I have it happen probably once a week. Somebody will just yell something. I'm like, okay, I don't think that guy likes me. And then I click the switch and level him.
Well, what seems really hard about that is that if it is like the greatest satisfaction, I imagine it is, in what you do for a living, to have people laughing along with you and finding you funny, it's got to be impossible not to take it personally when they don't, because it's you.
That's why I snap, and that they make fun of it all the time. Because I go up every night of the week. There's always rooms to go up. There's a lot of them are bar open mics. A lot of them are comedy club open mics. But you go up at them, and it's bound to happen at some point. I mean, especially if you're talking about Tiger Woods stuff, and they don't laugh, it doesn't matter, because there's no emotional investment there. It's just something you flipped off the paper. But when you're actually writing stuff about your life, and especially being as creative as me and Aaron are, like I really take it personal when people don't. Or especially when they're like, because we work clean. So when people are arms crossed, offended, I'm like, how are you even? There's so many worse things I could have said. And, and me doing a joke about buying cereal and your arms are crossed, like you're, and everybody else is laughing and clapping and you're staring at me like, how dare I talk about cereal? Like, That's what goes on in my head. He may have had a bad day, but in my head, I'm like, you don't like me because I talk about cereal. Like, that's what goes. So at that point, it really does affect me. I still get affected by bad sets, whether it be open mics, comedy clubs, you know, whatever shows.
So do you have a thicker skin, Aaron?
I wouldn't say that. I think that I've learned to not take the rejection of a joke personally. It's still kind of hard when you go up there and you didn't have fun, you know. And that's the thing. If I'm not having fun, then I don't know what's going on. But they can't all be fun. They can't all be great. They can't all carry you out on their shoulders, you know. Sometimes you're just going to have a lousy set. But we won't. Thursday, December 31st at the Backdoor Comedy Club for New Year's Eve.
214-328-4444.
Champagne toast at midnight.
Absolutely. But the thing is, you try out a new bit and they don't react to it. And I don't take that as a personal rejection anymore. The thing I've discovered, there's been like a switch in my brain as well where there's something obviously funny about this concept to me. You know, I took the time to really think about it and I wrote it down as a note. And then I'll get up on stage and try to wing something and then they don't laugh. And I've stopped thinking, okay, well, it's not a funny idea. I'll just scrap that. I realize that I just haven't learned how to communicate it yet. You know, and that's a big... I mean, that's the thing. It's like the germ of the idea in your notebook is one thing, but the whole process is all about fine-tuning, editing, you know, going up night after night, trying the same bit a few different ways. It becomes like a laboratory where maybe I need to keep this pause. Maybe I need to switch this word. So it's just figuring out how to best convey, because that, to me, that's the best feeling in the world. If there's something where I think that I'm alone in this really ugly thought, you know, like I'm really upset about something or something really confuses me, and I can somehow get an entire room of strangers to laugh at the exact same thought, then I feel like I've communicated something.
That's the cool thing about this city is like everybody's so, there's no industry in this city. So everybody's just truly about the art. There's literally no, Comedy Central's not coming here to scout. Nobody's worried about getting on this show or getting on this show. They just want to get the next big joke that all comics are like, wow, that's amazing. I wish I had that joke. And so because of that team mentality almost, I can do a new joke. And if he happens to be watching it, he'll tell me, hey, why don't you try this out? Or why don't you do this? Or like me and him were on a road trip probably a year ago. He had this joke he's been writing for like 4 years and we figured out the best way to perform it. Something that he hadn't thought of 3 years ago and I hadn't thought of 3 years ago. And now it's his closing joke. So it's weird how it's a constant process. You know, everybody's watching and like, hey, why don't you try this? Why don't you try this? Why don't you try this? And it's cool when it actually, you find a one-liner turn into this two-minute performance piece. You know, you remember the process when it started. And that's the cool thing for me, at least. So
it's interesting that you talk about sort of working together on each other's material occasionally, because we had this image of, you know, people will talk about like Saturday Night Live and the writers all competing and some of them may strike up friendships, but ultimately it's all about you want to be the one that's out there. Do you not experience that, or is it just something that you're able to compartmentalize?
Go ahead.
She's right. I hate you.
Yeah, now that I think about it.
No, I mean, when you're up there alone. You know, and if somebody can offer you something to like a different angle, there are times where I've gone out of my way saying, I know there's something funny here. I know there's a connection here. I don't know what it is. And I'll ask, you know, four or five, you know, of my friends, and they're like, well, have you tried this? Have you tried that? I'm like, okay. So, I mean, that makes sense. Every now and then you're working with like a touring headliner, and that's always a compliment to me, that the one bit that they'll come back and say, you know, that thing you did, I really like, you know, and then they'll offer like a line and it's such a gift. You're like, they totally didn't need to do that. And you're like, I'll at least give it a shot, you know, and then if it works, then boom, you know, it's in.
I think the other thing is people always think that all comedians kind of have the same sense of humor and they don't. I don't know what my sense of humor is. I think so many different things are funny. I don't pigeonhole it to where this is my sense of humor and this is my style. I don't even know what my style is. I just write everything that I think is funny. And I've been doing it 8.5 years. You've probably been doing it 8. Mm-hmm. There's a group of 4 of us that all started around the same time within a year of each other. And we happen to be the 4 guys that interact with each other the most because we've done it the longest. But we all 4 have totally different perspectives as to what we think is funny. We think the other one's funny, but we haven't gravitated towards a style.
So you couldn't do Aaron's set and he couldn't do yours.
I would tweak it to my, I mean, I think me and Aaron are probably, I would have to say that we're pretty flexible with what we do. I could probably do it, but what he thinks is funny, my brain doesn't even wire that way. I try to force it to. But even when he tells me, then I realize it's funny because I'm like, okay, that is really funny. I mean, I think it's funny, but my brain would never go that way. And so I'm trying to train myself to do that.
After all this time, it's still funny where, you know, we will do that. We'll like, you know, pitch stuff to each other. And then, you know, of the four, you know, two of them will go, why even suggest that? What are you talking about? And then you just can't explain it. Sometimes it's...
We've come to a point where you don't shoot other... It's funny because, like, remember this, a few months ago, we were sitting at the back door and I was pitching him this joke that was kind of been working. It was about how I live alone. And sometimes I find myself doing things that make me feel lonely. Like last week, I ate an entire birthday cake by myself, but it wasn't my birthday. Okay? That's the setup for the joke. I'm just pitching it to him. He stops me halfway and goes, wait a second, you ate an entire birthday cake? Why would you do that? I was like, I'm trying to get to the joke, buddy. So, I mean, it's stuff like that, though. I mean, like, but I never doubt what these guys are doing, you know, what any comic is doing. I mean, they obviously are trying to do something, but... What I love about, I mean, I can only talk about us four because us four, it's me, him, there's a guy named Raj Sharma who's going to be at the show as well, and Mark Agee. Mark's not going to be at that show, but, you know, we've been doing it so long to where we trust each other, and we're all just trying to be funny. We're all just trying to get a new joke out and trying to help the other person out. It really isn't a team concept in the sense of, like, you are on your own, and in the end, if I get on TV, you know, I can't pull these guys up with me onto Comedy Central. I can only do so much, but we don't have that mentality of competition because it's... We just don't have it. I can only say for us four, we don't have it.
There are times, though, where, you know, just because of a lineup, I will go out of my way to have the best set I can to make things just a little bit harder for the next guy.
Yeah.
I've been yelled at before.
You know, for being too good.
For being too good. Yeah, you know, that's what I'm trying to say, Chris. No, but I mean, it's funny because you do want to kind of push each other. And if it's a great night, I'm not going to apologize for anything or anybody. You go out and you have a great time, and all that does is kind of set the stage better for the next guy.
Yeah, it's healthy, you know? It's healthy competition. And there's a lot of comedians that come in, like especially like to the whatever clubs, and bring their own middle act. There's opener, middle, and the headliner. And they bring opening acts that suck. So they don't have to worry about being upstaged at any point. A lot of them do it. Almost like 99% of them do it. Because why would you want to risk not being the star of your own show that they came out to see? For us, I mean, me and him do a lot of shows together, and it's always pushing each other. Like, he's going to try to basically do so well that I can't do anything. That's his point, and I expect him to do that. And he can tell when he's really killed because I'll open with my closing joke. I have no choice, you know? So, but I appreciate that, because if I didn't have that, I mean, there's a lot of comics I could... That you know, we could work with, where you can just phone it in and still be the best comic of the night. But like at the show you'll see on New Year's, all those guys are top level people, all bring in their A game. So it's almost like a friendly competition that the audience basically in the end benefits by. So
what kind of cues do you use besides sort of observing how the audience responds to whoever's up ahead of you to size them up and to figure out before you even take the stage what you might want to adjust?
I see what they groan at. They're always going to groan at something. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but they're going to groan at something. And I see what they groan at, and then I take it from there. Also, like, for me, like, specifically, if there's, like, an Indian comedian, Raj is Indian, and he goes before me, and we might have something that he does isn't hitting, like, topic-wise, I'm not going to even touch that. I'm not going to do it. Like, sometimes, I've done shows with him where they're not responding to any of the Indian material he's doing, so I won't even do any of it. I'll just go straight, completely mainstream. But I also look at, if somebody's talking about drinking and nope, it's an older crowd and they're not really into drinking, they're not laughing. Okay, we'll take those jokes out. Or I always watch a couple of people specifically before me to see what I do.
I just look at hair color.
And, blue is one kind of joke.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, it's, you just kind of take a look at the crowd, see what they're laughing at. If it's an older crowd, I know, you know, I can get away with a little bit more family-friendly stuff, you know? If I'm talking to a college crowd, they're going to be staring at me. If I talk about, you know, my five-year-old, you know, whatever I think, they're all still pieces of me. They're all still, it's all still my material. It's just how I think I'm going to best benefit by sharing whatever this is with this particular crowd.
And that's the thing that we, that us four always try to do, is have a flexible set. You don't want to sit there and pigeonhole yourself to where I can only write about Indian material. That's my niche. Well, that's not your niche, because nobody's paying to see you. So you need to, you need to perform for that crowd that's in front of you. So you have to be flexible. So I force myself to write, you know, anything, any idea. That's why I don't censor myself when I write. I just write everything that pops in, because you never know when that's going to use. Because I do college crowds too. And, you know, there's only so much I can do about, they just haven't lived. They haven't lived. You know, if I talk about my parents trying to get me married, they don't care. They're basically just out of high school. They're 18. So I have to do material that I've written that they would understand the birthday cake joke better than, you know, my parents' arranged marriage. They don't care about that, so.
Well, tell me this. When you do perform, I know that you've done some benefits and stuff for largely, like, Indian crowds. Mm-hmm. How is the set different then? Do you leave out all the Indian stuff because they know it, or is that all they want to see?
No, we just did one on Friday, and that's the thing. That's all they want to see, is because there's no, outside of Russell Peters, there's no South Asian comics out there that are really making a dent. And so, and we're performing for those crowds, they're my parents' age. So that's a totally different beast altogether. Me and Aaron were talking about, we're probably, me, him, and Roger are probably the only comics in the country easily that could do those crowds, because they don't want to hear, it's not they don't want to hear, they're not going to boo you. But if I talk about birthday cake, they can't relate to that. They can't connect to that, because it's so weird and absurd. It's almost, stand-up is kind of a new art form to them, I guess, because Russell Peters is so huge because of that. He came in just at the right time. But they don't want to be cussed at. They don't want anything dirty. They want to be G-rated. So now you got a G-rated that makes your parents laugh, which is, for anybody, any comic would be impossible. But we've written that way, and they were incredible, you know. So yeah, that's all I can say. I don't know about you.
Love them. That's all.
Paul Varghese and Aaron Aryanpour are my guests. They are appearing on New Year's Eve at the Backdoor Comedy Club in Dallas for two special shows. You can find information at backdoorcomedy.com. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. If you want to be part of it, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are comedians Aaron Aryanpour and Paul Varghese, both of whom will be appearing at a special show at the Backdoor Comedy Club in Dallas on New Year's Eve. Find information at backdoorcomedy.com. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. We have an email here from Kyle in Fort Worth who says, I have some ideas for jokes that I think could be genuinely funny, but they just fall flat, I think, due to their structure. Any advice to joke writing in general?
Go ahead. We were staring at each other in silence. No, me and Aaron both took a workshop from Dean Lewis, who's a big comic here in Dallas. He's been around forever. He's basically like our Yoda. And he basically taught us like joke structure, which is the one thing you cannot, it helps. You can learn eventually, but he teaches you basically how to write a joke, and not like a hokey joke, like a real. He focuses on the personal, which is where I would never thought to even write that way had he not taught me. So he teaches workshops.
Sorry to interrupt you. What do you mean focuses on the personal?
He doesn't want to talk. He doesn't do the, hey, this is what's in the news and ba-doom, boom. Mm-hmm. The only reason we know about personal and talking about personal stuff is because of him. Because I remember I had a little notebook that I wrote before I even knew about his class. And it was the most boring, dumb stories that I thought were funny when I was little. But they would have never worked on stage. And so when he starts telling you to focus on what's wrong, what's frustrating, what's confusing, it's not a way that most comics think. Most comics think guys are just up there telling funny stories. Like Pryor's up there telling a story. He's not telling the story. He's starting with specific emotion, you know, and then he goes from there. You know, now maybe he doesn't sit down and write like, maybe he didn't sit down and write like that, but that's the crux of that.
When you're laughing at somebody next time, just try to figure out just for a second, why you find it funny and see if you can discover what the emotion is behind it. If we want to talk all, you know, art specific, when I looked at my notes too before ever taking the class, the difference between like a really bad journal entry, you know, if you think of it in terms of like prose versus poetry, and you got to realize that you want to say things with as few words as possible. So if you can say something that normally takes you 20 words in 10, that's better. If you can not say anything at all, you know, if you can just transmit the thought or the idea, and these are things that come with time. You got to, you know, trial and error. You got to take classes in performance. It's a matter of finding what confuses you, what upsets you, what you find odd, keeping it real, and then being able to communicate it in, you know, succinctly. And what I've learned from taking like improv classes, and I've loved those classes, is the moment you start thinking, hey, wouldn't it be funny if, then it's not going to be funny. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? The moment you start thinking tricky little thoughts, then you kind of sabotage yourself. So I'm pretty sure that Kyle, you know, he's got some great ideas. It's just a matter of, like I said before, figuring out how to best communicate that. And just by going up, you learn to edit, you know, you learn to convey, you learn to transmit, and, you know.
Yeah, there's, I mean, and that's what Dean helps. He basically fast forwards you through that. He teaches workshops all through Dallas, like every few months, whatever. But understand also that stand-up is performance art. It really is 90% performance. I mean, the writing is way, way important, but you have to go on stage to do it. Like, you can sit there. I know comics who waited 3 years to go on stage because they sat there with notebooks and they would come to open mics and watch and overthink it. And you don't want to get in your head at this point. You'll eventually get in your head, but you don't want to wait 3 years to make your debut at a little smoky bar. You know what I mean? Like, you're hyping yourself up way too much for what you're going to be let down for, what the reality is, you know? Like, you just need to go out there and just say it, you know? Everybody bombs. I bombed last night at the open mic. Everybody does it, but you just have to go out there and do it. And there's, again, this whole city is so supportive. All the guys who start out, the guys who are starting out now would probably easily embrace them and talk, and they'll all try to figure out what they're doing wrong, and they'll all go out together, and they'll all hang out at the open mics, and they'll all, you know, just workshop back and forth. That's what the city is great about. You can't get that in L.A. You can't get that in Austin. They're very clicky, you know, for the new people. So just go out there as opposed to just thinking about what's funny and waiting 8 months for your debut. Don't put too much pressure into it. Just jump out there. So
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Anar in Austin. Hi, Anar.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Great, thank you.
Hey, I wanted just to first say thank you so much for what you do. I really appreciate what would we do without comedy, particularly stand-up, which is so real, so theater in so many ways. So my question is, how do you actually practice your routine? Do you stand in front of a mirror? Do you record it either on tape or video, intonation, all that? That's my question, so I'll leave you with that.
Thanks for your call.
We were just talking about, we knew that question was going to come at some point. It always comes at some point. Hey, practice.
There's a lot of silent pointing at each other. Back
yeah,
forth,
yeah. Because we talked about this last night. We were like, somebody's going to ask us that.
We actually practiced that question in a mirror.
The tape recorder. And
no, I mean, if you have a thought and you don't want to lose it, yeah, tape record it. You know, we carry around like little DAT recorders or you know, just something. Or you'll see we both have notebooks. Everybody's got a notebook. The worst thing in the world is to wake up at 5 a.m. and go, oh my God, this connection that I've been trying to make, it's finally there. It's crystallized. And then not write it down. And then 10 o'clock that night going, I know this would be great. What was it?
Yeah.
You write it, and I mean, like, the only way you can practice it is to go up and try it, and that's the thing. The trick is, it looks like somebody's just talking off the cuff, and in reality, it's somebody who's been honing a thought for a very long time. So I don't want to kind of shatter the illusion.
I know comics who do practice in front of a mirror. I know a comic who has a mic stand in his living room and practices like that. But I'm like, you're feeding off the energy of the audience. So you might as well just be having a tea party with your stuffed animals, because it's a two-way conversation. I mean, you can sit there and say, okay, well, this is how I'm going to say it. Well, what if the audience doesn't laugh at that scripted version? You know, then what do? You know, so now you're stuck with this script that you memorized. It's not a script. It's a conversation with people. So I know for me, I would never want to practice into a mirror, because I would just feel self-conscious. Like, why is my eye doing this? And why am I looking this way? And why am I doing this? I do record myself and just go over the audio part of it. And the performance stuff, sometimes, okay, well, I'm touching my hand to my face too much, I'll do stuff like that. But I think you have to be in front of an audience. You have to. You can't sit there and practice at home because it's not. I may throw around the idea in my head while I'm not going to walk up there and just spontaneously say something. But to sit there and say, okay, I'm going to put my arm here and then I'm going to do some inflection here. I don't know until I go on stage and find out where the funny and where the beats are for me.
I'm getting over and over from both of you that for better or for worse, the audience is a part of the performance. Is it hard not to hold them responsible and sort of glower at them as they file out if somehow you bombed?
Oh, I blame them all the time.
I mean, they always tell you not to blame the audience. And 99% of the time, that's true. And the only reason they tell you not to blame the audience is because you have to have some self-awareness to be a good comic. You have to be self-aware to be like, okay, that didn't work and that didn't work. Because there's a lot of comics who come in thinking, okay, well, they just didn't get me. No, you just didn't know how to convey it. It can be the weirdest, most alternative thing that anybody's ever heard. Like Bill Hicks was way out there sometimes. Even Mitch Hedberg was way out there, but he found a way to convey it. He just didn't, you know, he found the way to phrase it the right way. I mean, you can't really, they say not to blame them because you just want to be able to be, edit your own stuff and figure out that it's not their fault. But there are times when the crowd's like, okay, they just, it's just not working at all.
I want to repeat something from one of those interview CDs of the Jerry Seinfeld, where he said that bad audiences help you edit and good audiences help you explore. And that's exactly what it is. It's like good audiences, you are in this moment together and they're allowing you some breathing room to kind of be more in the moment. So maybe you hold that look a little longer. Maybe you try a different line just because you're in that moment. You know, you're part of that bit and they're all... Everybody's having a good time, and then the bad audiences—they're not even bad. They're just letting you know when the joke's over. You know, they're letting you know, yeah, you know what? Just drop that part. You don't need that.
Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line is Bob in Wiley. Hey, Bob.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Enjoying your show as always.
Thank you.
The gentleman mentioned that someone, I believe the first name was Dean, held workshops around Dallas. I've got a nephew who has some talents and a great lot of interest in this, and I thought, wow, if I could get him in one of those classes, that'd make a great Christmas present.
Yeah, I know Dean's starting another one in January, so if you just call up the Addison Improv. I think you can look him up online too, but if you just call up the Addison Improv and ask for it, they can give you the information for that. I don't have it with me, so I'm just... recommending people, but it really does help. It really does help. He'll totally love it, and he also gets to perform at the Improv at the end of it all. So,
and the Addison Improv is just another club in the Metroplex, like the Backdoor Comedy Club, which you can reach at 214-328-4444 for tickets and information for the New Year's Eve show. Just thought I'd throw that out there,
just off the top of your head. You guys are both, I'm guessing, in your 30s.
Yeah.
So you didn't grow up like listening to Bob Newhart albums and stuff, did you?
I grew up listening to Cosby. The only reason I listened to Cosby is because that's the only thing my parents would let me listen to. Mm-hmm. So I grew up around that. I mean, it's a totally different era of comedy, though. Like, somebody who did Bill Cosby style now would never work. It would never work. I've always told Aaron, like, it's way more harder to do stand-up now than it's ever been. Anybody who says it's easy. Because all the topics that were original back then aren't original anymore. You know, you can't talk about airplanes anymore, which I fly, but I can't talk about it because that's considered hack and already been done. It's like, you know, you almost have to be 10 times more creative to be successful now, I feel.
It's also really hard to appreciate how groundbreaking something really is because everyone is just used to it, you know. But I find I'm like this with music and with comedy. I'll try to see what's out there, but then I always, the more I dig, the more there is to find, you know, and the more I keep digging. So, yeah, Cosby was really big when I was a kid. And just George Carlin and Bob Newhart and Steve Martin, just all these people that I just... just over in the last couple of years, just keep, you know, discovering and rediscovering and enjoying.
I think that there was, I don't know if he's hit this little moment yet, but I still really admire those guys' work, but I don't deify it as much as I used to. I used to be like, there's no way I could do that. There's no way I could be as funny as this guy, but I'm 8 years in. I'm like, okay, it looks attainable. I'm like, okay, I get it. I know how they do it. They're not like, you know, comedy gods that floated down with this knowledge that nobody else did. They just... you know, they figured it out. And so I don't hold them to this status where I could never be that guy. Because I think that's also a way to defeat yourself creatively. Like, well, I'm never going to be as good as George Carlin. Well, okay, well, you can be if you actually focus on what you're doing as opposed to chalking it up to this guy just randomly sat down and spit out brilliance. You know, he worked at it like everybody else.
What are you watching for and listening for the first time you see somebody perform that you haven't seen before?
my jokes.
I was just about to say that.
Really?
I honestly, yeah. No,
like fearing that they stole them?
Yeah, or lifting something. Mm-hmm. But you always look to see if they're because it's the truth. Though.
Really, that's
the
so
truth.
Funny.
I don't know what he looks.
You want to
at.
Talk about insecurity? It's the same thing though. It's because it may not even be outright theft, but you know, there's the idea of parallel thinking. And mm-hmm. if I've been doing a bit for a couple weeks or months, something I'm really proud of, and then somebody goes up with a similar thought, it can be devastating. You know, because all of a sudden now it looks like maybe you have lifted it from them, and you know that's why the more personal you are, the harder it is for somebody to kind yeah. of. Have that same parallel thought, you know.
It's the same way I do with when I'm doing jokes where I don't speak. I know if somebody starts doing stuff, that's the easiest way to see if somebody's actually lifting ideas. But there's going to be thoughts that are the same. There's going to be parallel thought, but you know, that's it's how they approach it. But on the flip side, like a lot of times when I see a new person coming up, they don't really have anything anyway. I mean, they're just hyped up about, you know, their very first time on stage. So it's really not anything. But I learn something from every comic I watch, though. Like, I just performance-wise and what not to do. More what not to do more than what to do from any comic, even, like, national headliners. Okay, I don't want to do that. I don't want to say this. I don't want to be this way. I mean, that's for me. That's how I learned. I used to watch comics like, oh, I would like to do that. Ooh, I would like to. I wish I had that kind of stage presence. And now the more jaded I get, I'm like, okay, what? I wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't want to do that.
I have to imagine that you all have spent time with people who've been at this for some time and don't seem to really be progressing. Is it harder to form like an intimate bond with someone who you don't think shares sort of your potential, or does that make sense?
There's a reason us four hang out. I mean, it sounds dumb, but like, you know, we started 8.5 years ago, and there was a lot of people, the faces around then are different from the faces that are here now. A lot of them acted like, for that first month or first 6 months, they were gung-ho. Hey, we're going up all the time. And then people get frustrated. They get frustrated by they can't write new material, or they're getting heckled at open mics, or they're not progressing where they're getting work at clubs. And so they just fizzle out, and they just leave, and they come back every 8 months, or they come back every couple of years. In the
Sometimes
end...
Sometimes with the same material. I mean, yeah. It's just like... That's the thing, is in order for me to keep up with my buddies, I've been challenged to just keep showing up with something new. And it's helped me a lot, just because I know I've got that much more material now than I did 6 months ago, a year ago.
We didn't randomly decide, okay, I'm gonna hang out with you and I'm gonna hang out with you. We just happened to be the four from 8.5 years ago that ended up sticking with it. You know, like there's no other guys that have been doing it 8.5 years around that same time that are still doing it. So we just happened to naturally gravitate towards each other. So I don't think we handpicked anybody. I didn't, at least. Maybe they handpicked me. I don't know. I like to think I was handpicked. Was I?
Paul Varghese and Aaron Arianpour, we'll have to end it with that, are performing at the Backdoor Comedy Club on New Year's Eve for two shows that take place in Dallas. You can find information about the appearance at backdoorcomedy.com. Guys, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.